Art of Departure 5 on November 5th, 2023. Being aware of matters of life and death before, during, and after death, which is what the Art of Departure is all about, is just looking at different aspects of this element that we all share, no matter what. Even if we believe different things, we are here temporarily. So I heard a great quote, the idea that everyone's going to die except for me. People die and you hear about it and you think, oh yeah, well, that's not me. That's something that happened to them. Yeah, we have some new people, some returning people, some for some of the time, some for maybe most of it. This is a testament to continuing to keep somebody on your list, right, Suze?
It sure is. How many years is this, eh?
Oh, man, 2005?
Oh, wow. That's great. Well, I had listened to the other podcasts, at least one of them, and it was so powerful. I thought, this is beautiful. And then life got in the way and I didn't keep track, but I'm here today. So thank you for
that's
your persistence.
Awesome. Yeah, for sure. It's great to see you.
Thank you.
Bobby is going to join us. She thought she'd be just a little late. Yeah, Laura, Mystic Without a Monastery. I just love that handle. Yeah, and today is my dad's 4 years since he died, November 5th, 2019, just before all the craziness. Yeah, mom died in 2014, my sister Chris in 2015, and then dad in 2019. Yeah, I'm very grateful. Yes, to return to Ontario to be around closer to. And the Art of Departure started last spring after Feather was visiting me in February from BC. We'd known each other since 1978 when we were both heading out west, hitchhiking across the great land of Canada. Anyway, she came to visit me in February. And at that point, I wanted to get going on a thing for authors, how to go through the postpartum of publishing, and also to have this kind of idea of the Art of Departure, talking about before, during, and after death. And wow, I mean, this is the fifth one. And like the fourth one was on October 4th, my mom's birthday. This one's on November 5th, number five on my dad's death day. And I was looking ahead, Laura, after you inspired me to jump on it for this one. I looked ahead and saw that December 6th for Art of Departure 6 is my grandfather's birthday. So, I mean, I could keep going like this, right? Just make it the next number of each month. I'm kind of inspired. I think this could be the way to go. And every time there's more, there's different people, there's different ideas, different insights shared. Every one of them has been different. And I'm super excited to be here and welcome you all. Just so honored that you would join in for this unknown spontaneous tour of the Art of Departure 5.
Feather?
So I'll just share that today is also a special day in my life on November 5th. My mentor here on the physical plane, who I'd known since the age of about 28. Anyhow, she had passed 10 years ago, and I live in a spiritual community, and today we're celebrating this passing. And yeah, it's kind of amazing to keep the spirit of whoever we love alive. And some people say, oh, you shouldn't do that. And it's like, let them go. But re-remembering her in ways of how she influenced myself and many others in this community has been wonderful reflection. And I just want to share, though, the mystical side of her passing for me. I was in Thailand, and I had decided to go for a walk on the beach one day, you know, just somebody told me. And I didn't know she had passed. And there in the sand was this really giant feather, like just blown into a picture by the sand. And I looked at that and I walked around it and my heart was beating very fast. I said, something's going to happen in my life. I don't know what it is, but something big is coming down the pipe. I just saw it as a beautiful sign of something. And shortly after that, I think within a week's time, I got the news from her daughter that she had passed. So I thought this was a beautiful sign from her to me beforehand. Then after I found out that she had passed, and, you know, I went back to that beach spot more or less and did a little ceremony in the sand. Just did a little ceremony then to honor her. So today she's quite present in my consciousness. And yeah, I'm grateful for those who have gone before that have been my mentors and have helped me on my path. So thank you.
Thank you, Feather. Go ahead, Ev.
Interesting that you just brought this up spontaneously, because the second was my mom's death day in 2012 at 93. And I thought about her and how ironic it was when we had the death talk, you know, when she was 90, or I think she was 89. I thought it might be, you know, time to have the chat with her about death, because she wasn't particularly, she wasn't spiritual or religious. So I kind of thought to myself, how would that be for somebody who's, you know, not anything really, to be imminently aware of passing? So I had read this beautiful book by a guy named Michael C. Newton called The Journey of Souls. So I was really amped up on talking to her about it and bringing it up. So I said to her, you know, Mumsy, what do you think? I mean, this really great book. What do you think happens when you die? And she looks at me and she says, nothing, you're finished. You know? And I was like, oh, okay. Not really anywhere to go with that one. So we'll just leave that alone. But the beautiful piece was that she went on November 2nd, which is actually the Day of the Dead in Mexico, where they celebrate every year those who have gone, by bringing food and beers and alcohol and candles and music to the gravesite and having a big party, remembering that person and laughing and telling funny stories about them and eating and just being silly, celebrating that person. So that's kind of what I did on the second as well, was just tell some stories about her, some funny things that she said and funny remembrances. So yeah, anyhow, glad to be here. Thanks, Lynn, for reminding me.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ev. So glad you could join us. I know it's late where you are, so stay as long as you
all
can.
Good. Thanks.
Rudy?
Let's see, I'm coming from San Antonio, Texas, where Dia de los Muertos is a very big thing here in South Texas. The Latino culture, Latino population of San Antonio is the vast majority, 65% or so. So I've been thinking a lot about my parents over the last couple of days because of Dia de los Muertos. And I did a concert on Friday night, the 3rd, and wanted to sing about them. And I'd gotten 8 bars into the song, my throat just verklempt. I just couldn't. I couldn't. I stopped and paused and recollected myself and started again a minute or so later in a good way. But it was such an odd feeling. It was almost as if I my mother's spirit was saying, don't sing about me. I'm too shy. Don't sing about me. You know how shy I am. I'm a singer, songwriter primarily, although I'm learning how to write prose, or unlearning how I've been writing prose for 40 years. I've written a lot, but I'm trying to write now in a new, fresh way about aging and dying and struggling with it. So I'm here this evening in part to hear more stories about how other people are dealing with their impending death and the deaths of their loved ones. Not just as a story vulture trying to see what bones I can pick out of your stories, but yeah, to pick up some courage and some willingness to go a little deeper than the surface. And finally, I guess I would share that 3 weeks ago, I fell in my backyard and fractured my kneecap. Hurt a lot. So it happened my wife was out of town at the time. I live kind of isolated on the edge of town. Screamed for help. There was nobody to help. Couldn't reach my phone. I clearly wasn't dying. I knew I was just a busted knee. I could feel. I heard the kneecap pop. It felt awful. It was more pain than I've ever had in my life that I can remember. The reason I'm telling you all this is because for like a minute. I just felt like, oh, this is what it'd be like to die alone and in pain. And it's not so bad. And it's not so bad. Just breathe into it and it's no big deal. So, yeah, that's what I have to say on the subject right now. And I look forward to hearing what you have to say on the subject. Thanks for listening.
Oh, my goodness, Rudy, you're always so inspiring and intriguing in whatever you share. Thank you so much for that. That did make me laugh. It's not so bad. Tony.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tony Gittles. I come to you from Orlando, Florida. And I met Lynn. She was the editor on my new book, 21 Mistakes Caregivers Make and How to Avoid Them. So I'm busy right now promoting the book. I just got off a cruise. I did a conference at sea for family caregivers who are taking care of loved ones with dementia. And one of the spouses had very late stage dementia, and her husband was a really 24/7 caregiver. She was very challenging for the staff as well. So I do these cruises once a year, although I'm going back in January, we're doing another cruise. So, you know, death is imminent for people with Alzheimer's and this kind of disease. It will kill them. It is a gradual progression of disease, and to watch the family caregivers go through the stress and the love, but the ups and downs of caring for a spouse is, it's very draining actually, but we are there to support them and to have them create memories. And we did a good job of doing that, but this was a challenging group this time. I'm in a relationship with a gentleman who took care of his wife who had early onset Alzheimer's and was privileged to participate with him during his journey. I met his wife, did some caring for her, and did some caring for my partner, Dennis, as he lost his wife and went through the grieving process. And I had never been so intimately involved with anyone who had grieved the loss of a spouse. So it's been 2 years. It's still ongoing. It's an interesting journey. He took a grief called Grief Share and met other spouses who had lost their spouse, some recently, some, you know, years ago, but they all connected and formed a social group. So we now have a social group of spouses that have been through this Grief Share program. And some of them have remarried. And when we get together once a month, we actually talk about where everybody is, but it's more of a social event, or we go to the theater. We haven't yet really focused on the dying part, but we do know their stories. Everybody knows each other's stories and the emotional toll that it took. So that's where I am. I lost my mother 5 years ago. I took care of her for 14 years. That's where the book came out of, and my current career working with family caregivers. That's where we are, Lynn, and everybody. I really just got home and saw your email and went, okay, I'm here. I want to see Lynn and her group.
Awesome. That's great, Tony. I know, it was just this morning I realized, oh, Tony might be able to come.
I should be preparing. I've got 5 presentations this week for National Caregivers Month. So, but I'm not. I'm here. Relaxing.
You are a busy girl. And I just gave your book to Laura. We just traded books. She gave me her book and I gave her yours. Stephanie, would you like to share your presence with us?
For me, I like to perceive reality from a quantum perspective. Death is part of that quantum perspective. For example, when the body dies, 21 grams leaves the body. So just a little bit of quantum stuff. I really just wanted to check out Lynn's work and see what she was up to. So that's why I'm here.
That's great. Just to clarify, did you say 21 grams?
Yes. So there was this experiment done where they had people that they knew were going to pass and agreed to be put on the quantum scale. And when they passed, 21 grams left the body. So we don't really die. This is just I call this an energetic holographic video game reality that we're living in at the moment, where our thoughts and emotions are remote controlled.
It's a lot to take in, really.
As I was going through this shift in perspective, it took a while to reprogram your mind, right? And not that's what knowledge does, is it helps you to shift your perspective. Actually, that's what the name I go by online is, Perception Shifter. So yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Oh, and Zach's here too. He's listening in.
Oh, hi, Zach. Yeah, I figured he'd probably be nearby.
He's right there. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I've just met Stephanie and Zach recently through the Druthers newspaper. And that's also where I met Laura. Christina.
Hi. I know a few of the writers for Druthers. Did you go to an event or something that they had?
Yeah, they have a cafe every Thursday from 2 in the afternoon till 10 in the evening. So I've been to all 10 of them, 10 for 10.
Okay, well, I've been to, I think, 4 out of 5 on these, Art of Departure. So I've been a little preoccupied even on this call and all day and all weekend, because my mother is 95 in Spain. And this is my birth mother, who I didn't meet till I was 22. So I've lived in Canada all my life, and she's lived in Europe all her life. I was adopted. So at the end of her life, I'm dealing with a lot of logistical stuff, a lawyer that has power of attorney that doesn't respond to my emails, a caregiver that overcharges a ton of money. The caregivers are all making more, way more money than they should. A caregiver that said, I'm going to make sure when the house sells, it's already sold and the people are allowing my mother to live in the house until death do her part. And now the caregiver says, I'm going to make sure I spend all Mary's money, my mother's money, so Christina doesn't get any of it. She actually said that to the other caregiver. So, and then when I was there last year with my son, there was a lot of animosity towards me as though I was only there to protect my interests, my inheritance. And so that's what the lawyer somehow believes. And so it's really messy. And so now I have to hire my own lawyer, get a security system into the house to watch who's coming and going and how long they're staying. And there's nothing left at the end of the day as far as inheritance goes anyway. So there's nothing to protect. It's just to look after her. So it's kind of interesting, because if we could just eliminate money in our whole consciousness, imagine that. Oh my God. Because there's always seems to be some conflict. So I was saying to, I have a few allies over there. One of the caregivers, very good friend, lovely. The other hates me. And then this other man that visits my mother every Saturday. So I talk to my mother. She says she wants to, and then she gets distracted by the TV. And she thinks that I'm in trouble because people are going to kill me because I'm Jewish. She's not. So I'm not either, because it came through the patriarchy. But whatever's on the TV, she's like, she translates it somehow to me. And so she's worried I'm going to get killed because I'm Jewish. It's like, that'll be the last thing I have to worry about. But so it's just interesting how at the end of life, all these things come up around money and finances. And my aunt just died. My father died. And there's always some kind of discrepancy or just gets in the way, and it's usually money and power and control. So I don't want any of that. I only have one kid to concern myself. Nobody's going to fight over anything because I have nothing to leave. So we're all good. I don't want anything from it, you know. So I'm leaving my love, and that's it. So I think that I do need a will. You know, I'm kind of out of the system and out of the matrix, and I'm trying to do it without all of that. I think you can write a will on toilet paper even, and it's valid. But I really don't want to do the matrix system, because I think that's what creates the division. The two caregivers are like Hamas and Israel, or, you know, like there's conflict everywhere in families. And what is it usually? It's power and money. So how to navigate my own course of action without, yeah, my kid doesn't expect anything anyways, like that. He's of a new mind, of a new earth, that's not important. And to so many people it is, because we've been conditioned and programmed, and television and everything that's programmed us to believe that this is how it goes, and standard, and, you know, all this stuff about inheritance. So I just want freedom now before I go and to do it all here now. I like the idea of the 21 grams leaving the body. I'd like to find out the source of that information, because that interests me. And I also have 5 planets in Scorpio, so I dive deep into the occult. into the underground, into the underworlds. It's my nature too. So I'm quite intuitive. I've interviewed several people that have woken up with their feet tagged. Danian Brinkley, Betty Eady. She didn't wake up with her foot tagged, but she had a near-death experience. But he did. Danian Brinkley died three times near death. And then Paul Elder, who wrote The Eyes of an Angel. So between those three, fascinating, fascinating tales and inconsistencies in all three stories. There's also a difference as to what beliefs they had going in, whether what religion they were and what they believed in Christ. And Danian Brinkley saw gorgeous angels and he said, there ain't no hell or I would have been going there. So they all have their wake up calls for all of them. So I was fascinated and I got to interview them and introduce them in Vancouver. So it's always been one of my passions. I believe we're, you know, this is all an illusion and we made it all up and now we think it's real. So that's my theory. Hey, look forward to the conversation. Thanks, Lynn, as always.
Thank you, Christina. 4 for 5. It's good. Good ratio. Laura, you're up.
All right. Well, it's such a pleasure to be here with everyone. And I am an author as well. I wrote Fully Committed, The Sacred Sojourn of the Soul, which is about the hero's journey from a soulful perspective. And that journey really reconstructed me and my identity in many ways. And the journey since then has been a very deep dive into the fictitious reality and the matrix and all of the identities that we have taken on that have overlaid the reality of what is real to now be in galleries where it feels very real because we're all real in our own individual spaces. And then just figuring out how to see the discrepancy between the magnetic fields of our own hearts being able to overlap when we're in shared space compared to in a gallery, which is what we've all been really pushed into with all of the insanity over the last few years. So that is where I go into the head and the matching where I've heard. And as I sat listening to everyone's stories, I've thought about just how disconnected in many ways I have been from death. My grandma passed away in 2020, which was a very much a descanso. So life stopped in that experience, not when she died, but in when she tried. And I got roped into a crazy experience that I don't speak of expressly publicly because I want to honor her memory, but I've not been able to grieve her loss because of the situation that I got put into and then how that completely shifted everything. And I have a disconnected relationship with death in some ways because I do see this reality to be where we are now. And then the soul is the energy inside of us that is the 21 grams, as you said, that ultimately leave the vessel and then goes into another experience where we're not this version of us, but the all goes back to all that is from my perspective. So I don't have a fear of death specifically, but I haven't necessarily had a near-death experience myself. And I have had death and loss around me, but I feel like I've kind of, as a mystic without a monastery, without the title specifically, it's Carolyn Miss's work. If anyone has heard of her reference to mystics without monasteries, it really resonated for me when I heard that, because I've never been religious and spiritual, but without necessarily, I've just kind of piecemealed my BS belief systems, as I call them, to create what I consider reality and then see the fictitious nature of all of it still. So I've been on a deep dive this year, diving into the Justinian connection or deception that ultimately has us believing in all of these counterfeit versions of reality, which Lynn and I were speaking about Anubis and coming up from the underworld through the signature line to drag us into the death cult, essentially. And so that was part of what prompted this. But as I sit here, it's like, wow, it is such a shared experience. And it is so, so important. And especially with the number of deaths that are increasing nowadays, it seems a lot more people, a lot more souls are passing. And we really need to know how to support the people that are left behind, because we all grieve in our own way. And if we don't find the way that works for us, then we turn to, from my perspective, the mental health system oftentimes is the modern day witch hunt legalized and normalized. And it doesn't solve anything other than get us into a spiral of pharmakia and taking drugs in order to move us further towards the toxic load that's already getting too high as to why, you know, dementia and other aging ailments, or, you know, brain fog or things, when the toxic load is too high, and then we either die or we have to let the load, the toxic load, leave. And so as I sit here and I have lots of thoughts, but then it's just recently, it's been more about just connecting and seeing the people. And I lead so many groups and so many calls, and I'm really trying to bring people together to do what we're doing here. And I see the need to not be the one to try to call all of the meetings at all, but just show up where meetings are already being held to see the richness. Because I delved into the New Age movement to an extent without knowing that was what it was specifically. But in doing so, I heard the term anti-corona, and that's the web of light that connects us all. And over the last while, it's come to me that we've become so information obsessed that we forgot it was us that were the dots that needed to be put into formation. And we're the ones that, when we're connected, we have the light. And that's where that web of interconnectedness comes from my perspective. So I'll end there. And I don't believe Suzanne has had an opportunity to share yet.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Laura. Yeah, and Lynn, and it's wonderful to be here. I have been obsessed for probably a long time in many ways, but with the interests of near-death experiences, whether through Next Level Soul or Suzanne Giesman or, you know, Near Death Diaries, all of that, there's much to look at. And I'm quite compelled. But personally, I have a brother in Ontario nearing the end of his life. And, you know, making that decision of whether I jump on a plane and go out and see him. And as a number of things happened, I just really sat with that decision and felt as though our conversations are basically now, I love you and thank you. And we keep saying that, honoring each other in that. And I don't feel the need to rush out there to do that. He's got, you know, there's wife and two sons and other family that have been with him on the journey. I'm the youngest in the family. I've gone and lived in different places in the world, and I'm in BC and they're in Ontario. So that kind of family connection is quite different when you're the youngest and then when you've lived away. And currently, my husband's brother-in-law, his sister's husband, has entered hospice, and that's on the mainland, Vancouver. And he's what looks to be, and I've heard, is a beautiful hospice, 10-bed home. Their name is Crossroads, which just made me smile. And the care that he's given now is such tender love, and the family can be there with him. And again, it's that other one of removed, you know, the husband of the person that's brother-in-law. I mean, and their sons have come, one from Japan and one from Australia and all of that. So it's, I guess, try to put it into a short form is having to go deep within my own self, and what is my truth in this, in my relationship with that person? What is that I want to do? What is it that I need to do? And it's been interesting in watching or being with people in their own process of acceptance of death or denial of the process we're in, and then being able to walk with those that are in their denial, that they don't even want to look at, and their loved one is dying. They won't say the word. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to see any kind of podcast. So it's acceptance of where they're at And yeah, so I was very interested in that, the such respectful podcast that I listened to, Lynn. I think it might have been Tony. I heard her on that podcast. So it's an honor to be here, to be with all of you. We're on the same journey, and there's this interest that's pretty big in our life. And it's wonderful to be able to be here. So thanks.
Thank you. And thanks, Laura, for speaking and for your prompt for Suzanne to share. Suze, I was just going to say that there were so many things about my father's death 4 years ago today, you know, that stay with me. And one is that leading up to it, it was about 5 weeks, like 3 weeks or so in the hospital. And then we got him back into his community, into another room where he could be. And it was really crazy because I thought that when he was at that point and still pretty with it, that he would be more philosophical as he had been. He called himself a philosophical accountant. And a really good friend of his who had mentored him before she died, in a way, he was always admiring how she saw it as a great adventure that she was launching onto or into. And going into his 90s, he seemed to come into a place of wondering why he was still alive. You know, a lot of friends had died. He'd been to a lot of funerals. And then when his body started sort of shutting down piece by piece, his mind was still pretty there. I was just really taken aback that he didn't want to go there talking about what was happening. He was wanting to resist it. And I remember one day sitting with him in the hospital and saying, you know, is there anybody you want me to set up a phone call with? Is there somebody you want to talk to? Anything you know, can I help you do something? And there was nothing that was coming through. So I said, I just turned it around and I started thanking him for things and thanking him for different aspects of our relationship and things that he'd taught me when I was younger, things, you know, the cottage and enjoying nature and canoeing and camping and just simple life. And now I lived in so many rustic cabins, probably because of that. And then when he died, I wasn't there. I had a driving job and I had to drive that night. I had to go away. And then by the time I was ready to drive back, the hour and a quarter, I got a message from my brother that dad had died. And, you know, I'd been able to be there for so many of our family. And, you know, but one of the things that Bobby mentioned and that I've heard from other people as well is that people don't always want people right there with them, you know, when they die. So I think it's important not to take that personally or feel like you've done something wrong. And there was a tip in one of the other Art of Departures that when you're sitting, perhaps you're taking turns sitting with somebody in hospice or palliative care, that, you know, once an hour you say, I'm just going to be stepping out for about 10 minutes and then I'll be back. And then it gives them an opportunity. If they do want to slip away, they know that every hour they have a chance, they have an exit door, you know? And I thought that was so cool. I had never thought of that before. And I think that's really wise, because I'm sure, you know, when we find ourselves in that bed, not going anywhere and needing help, we may feel a little stuck and not with as many options as we feel like we have now. So, you know, it's good to sort of keep that in mind as to the limits of that place when we're at that place. Feather, thank you so much for being here and letting us know.
I have a further commitment. Maybe I'll come back if I don't have to do the dishes. See you all later, perhaps, or also I'll tune into the podcast later. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Thank you, Feather.
Lovely meeting you, Feather.
Bye-bye.
Oh, I will just add that this morning, it wasn't as dramatic as what you described, Rudy, but when I got up, I had this sort of dizzy feeling, like, you know, how you sort of go sideways, like you can't quite, you know, makes you appreciate how you usually go straight. Boy, that was a weird feeling, and it didn't go away right away. And I thought, whoa, I sure appreciate my independence. And I get it more. I've helped a lot of elders in their later years and to their deaths, a lot of family friends, like who were the parents of my friends. And then I've helped them. They've, you know, been really independent, intelligent people. And it's challenging to see them challenged, you know, by becoming more dependent. And especially with their vision. Now I take these little drops every night at 10:30 before I go to bed for the rest of my life so that I can still see. And that must mean that I'm getting a little older. So yeah, so passing the baton to anyone who's inspired.
My father worked as a nursing home administrator for 30 years. And after he'd been there 15, 20 years, he told me that he noticed people become more like themselves the older they get, and that people die the way they live. So those who are fearful or angry tend to die fearfully or angrily. And those who are cheerful folks go out with a smile and go out relatively easily. My mother was a very fearful person, very loving, very kind, but she grew up with great trauma in the Depression and then lived through the horrors of Japanese occupation in Indonesia in World War II and really suffered from that point on and throughout her life with great pain. And she died an awful death by Parkinson's disease and post-polio syndrome that took a couple of years. She died by inches every day. And it was excruciating pain. And my father was a happy-go-lucky fellow. And at age 95, he was still living on his own and driving his own car. And I had a 75-year-old girlfriend that lived an hour away. He drove to see her several times a week, spend the night. Just the king of the hill. Then he got an intestinal blockage, and 2 days later, he heard a doctor say he would never eat solid food again because it was inoperable. And 48 hours after that, he was done. But he waited until all six of his sons and their families were present. He was very much an outgoing man. He loved to be the life of the party. He always had a story to tell. He had one last story to tell. And when the last brother showed up with his wife, finally from a snowbound flight out of Colorado, 15 minutes later, my dad was gone. He had his audience. He had one last, look at me. I'm peaceful. I'm breathing. I'm bye. I tell you this because from that lesson that occurred 4.5 years ago, I renewed my desire to live joyfully and easefully as much as possible, and to release my fear of death and of not having enough and dying in a nursing home in pain and poverty. All fears I used to have, and I now choose to live as if I'm going to be taken care of. I have all the resources I need to live until the last minute. And I think of it as my long-term care insurance policy. Rather than trying to put money in the bank to save for that, I'm going to put love in the bank to save for that and to affirm that I die peacefully. And the last piece of that is a personal practice I've adopted, which is most mornings I get up before the sunrise and I do what I do mindfully and prayerfully as much as possible. And then I go out and greet the sun, but do the four directions: east for the new beginning, the south for the blessings. And in the west, I see is the direction of death. And I take a minute or two to practice dying. If this is the moment I'm dying, how does it feel? How does it feel to just let go of everything and be here? Now, and then the north, that's the direction of challenge, just standing into whatever challenges face me that day. And that feels right for me, to spend a minute or two almost every day just practicing taking my last breath, practicing being mindful so I can approach that transom when I get there as peacefully and mindfully as possible. Is that bullshit? Maybe. But it seems as good a practice as any. And yeah, so that's what I understand about death, my personal experience with death. Except for one more thing while I'm rattling on. I got to be I had my father's power of medical attorney and was the one who decided with him to go into hospice care, which lasted, for, like I said, for 48 hours. And then he was done from the moment he went home with the morphine. And I was the one administering morphine every hour, and or however long and the intervals were. And in the last hours of his life, the little living room where he had his bed set up was increasingly filled with my five brothers and their families and the nieces and nephews and the cousins and the neighbors. Everybody wanted to come say goodbye to Benny. And he had the room. He had a standing room audience to witness his death. And when he finally passed, it was very peaceful. I was holding his hand. He took his last breath. Everybody wanted to come and touch him. And so it was just suddenly too much for me. And I went to his neighbor's house just to go sit quietly and meditate and release the experience of having sat with my dad so intensely and all the energy of all the brothers and nieces and nephews. And as I sat in the neighbor's house meditating, I hadn't been there more than 5 minutes. I hadn't done my little deep breathing and opening and blah, blah, blah. And then my dad came to me. As clearly as I'm talking to you now, and seeing your face, as his presence was with me, and I heard his voice say to me, "Thank you, Rudy, but it's time for you to grow up. It's time for you to do what it takes to get sober and stay sober. I mean it." I heard it as loud as clear as possible. I've been sober since. So anyway, that's my story.
Thank you. Amazing what it takes sometimes.
That was so beautiful.
Thank you for sharing that, and that knowing that you have now. It's so beautiful. It just is, and you know. And yeah, I just say he walks with you. Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was so profound. And I feel like I'm on this call for so many reasons. And I love that I'm here and with each of you. So thank you for that. And it's just your dad coming to you. It's just the reminder of, it's just like, we're all energy in form until we're not. And there's the aspect of us that can leave the form without necessarily fully disconnecting, because it's the cords energetically that we have between one another and then also with the higher self, my belief systems. It reminds me of, we're all really here to walk each other home to ourselves, not to some source outside of us or resource, but us, source, the source that connects, that we all come from. And it's just like, if we could just drop the walls of all the BS of everybody's belief systems to see that the words are only the boxes that put the energy into a form. So if we just dropped the walls and saw the words to be the way that we could actually have bridges between those words to see the different things or syntax that we put onto those words, which is the meaning assigned to the words, as I'm sure you're all aware, it's just like, then we stop sinning with tacks and we can get back to what's real. I like to play with words too. I also wanted to just bring in a perspective that is very relevant to this call, actually, in terms of the martyr, even though it's disconnected from how this feels, because this is a very beautiful experience. But it came to me a couple months ago about the martyr being a very active archetype within our culture. And it's largely been the scared martyr, it seems, that has been afraid of what happens if we don't do the thing, like the kamikaze pilot, you know, that doesn't get the reward for not doing the thing, or, you know. And I feel like we have culturally become very familiar with the scared martyr that has to die for something. But it occurred to me that the opposite could be the sacred martyr, which is one who actually lives for something. So I offer that here. What would it be to live for something, or for all of those that came before us? I just wanted to share that.
Go ahead, Christina. Thank you, Laura.
Hi. Well, I'll just go on the martyr theme. So I used to have that beautiful painting of her. She's going down the river, her hands behind her head. It's called The Martyr. It's a French painting. I can't remember. I remember when I gave it away, it was partly to give away a continuum of the archetype that I've had in lifetime after lifetime, you know, as a sacrifice, because even if it's sacred, it's still a sacrifice, because martyr means you are in sacrifice. And I think we've lived our life, many lifetimes, in sacrifice for somebody else's gain. Perhaps what comes to mind is Lady Di. When she passed away, the whole world was given permission to mourn, whether they actually believed they were mourning over that one person, but really it gave them permission to feel their own loss. And then a week later, Mother Teresa died, who may be considered a martyr. And there's no accident that she died in the wings of the princess, because she didn't get any media attention or any attention. In other words, kind of died as she lived. There was, you know, maybe it kind of came out a little bit, but it wasn't a big deal because she was old, maybe, but because of Princess Di taking up so much of it. So I think it's a martyr that I personally let go of in this lifetime, because I've done it so many times. I've been a priestess in many lifetimes and sacrificed for the greater good. And that's what this whole programming was about, is to martyr yourself for the greater good, to think of others. And it was all bullshit, of course. The greater good is when you think it's, there's nothing wrong with being self-centered or centered in the self. Because if you're taking care of your soul's desires and your soul's and your body and your own needs, you're taking care of everyone else energetically by increasing your own frequency. So to me, whether it's sacred or sacrilegious, it's an archetype that kind of I'm done with in my life. Someone else can do it, but I'm sure not going to continue that one, because it hasn't served anybody. And I think that's where it comes down in the end. It really doesn't serve anybody except maybe, you know, a few factions of tyranny people. But today, I think, I don't know if it's been mentioned, but today is Guy Fawkes Day. And it kind of reminds me, I kept thinking of this rhyme. Remember the 5th of November. And V for Vendetta wrote the script for 2020, completely wrote the script. It's all about a virus. And it was Natalie Portman and Hugo Weaving, John Hurt recounting the crusade of V, a Guy Fawkes. So he played this costume anarchist and freedom fighter who stages a series of terrorist attacks against an oppressive fascist government in a futuristic dystopian United Kingdom in the hopes of triggering a revolution. I think that is significant that today is that day, because we, I believe, are in a death cult, and we have been for a long time. And this planned pandemic and propaganda has been going on since 1913, but before that, but since they were able to take over the education system. So even death is an illusion in my studies of Course in Miracles and everything else that I've studied. It's not real, but we've put so much emphasis on it, yet we probably have never thought of it so much as in the last 3 years. Even the fact, why didn't we do an Art of Departure 10 years ago? We weren't thinking in these terms. We weren't concerned. Maybe we weren't as old. There's that part of it. So we weren't thinking about it, but that it wasn't something that we really gave as much attention to as we have in the last 3 years. Why is that? Because they're trying to kill us one way or another, through frequencies, through 5G, through chemicals, whatever. So it's like we're seeing the resilience of the human spirit and the human body beyond what they can do. If they can't do anything, it's like this time we're not going down. And many times before, we have the burning times, the witch burnings, who hasn't been there and, you know, been part of that in past lifetimes. So this time I believe we're rising, and that's what they're trying to stop, is the ascension process. And maybe, I mean, look, people are now sliding the other way, but they've lived longer than ever. I was told I'm going to live to 200. It's like, that's impossible, but maybe in 10 years, that's not impossible. So here we are planning our end, but really we need to be planning the life that we're existing in right now to maximize it, you know, so that when I go down, it's orgasmic. And what's for me is I'm glad I'm doing unmute because I'm going to focus this unmute on what is the legacy I want to leave. You know, that to me would be a lovely conversation because I don't have one really. I don't, you know, I don't have a book. And I feel like maybe that there needs to be a little more substance than just a memory or a bench, you know. Although I like that thought, Lynn, I like the idea of having a bench with my name on it, but more like, what's my legacy? What did I contribute? What did I change? How did I make a difference? How, not how much money I made or what business I ran, but how did I change a life, you know, influence in a good way? That's sort of where I'm at. And I turned 66 this week. So it's a fascinating time. I don't feel whatever that's supposed to feel like, although I am a little tired, but yeah. So, you know, we're getting one step closer all the time. It's kind of like, you know, even 66, maybe it's the new 46. Because I think I want a man about that young. That would work well for me. Keep me young. Thanks. That's it for me now.
I love your orgasmic exit as well. That is a fantastic aim to go out with. Boom.
Well, that would make a good book title.
I'm sure you would get quite a few readers.
Thank you for that, Christina. So many things. Yeah, I turned 66 in the spring. I was just thinking about, am I 66 or 67? Whoa, 67 soon next spring. That means I'm really close to 70. And then people like Rudy can tell me how young I am, right? legacy, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think legacy is so much more than a bequest to somebody or something. I mean, a legacy is definitely like Rudy was saying too, like just how you're living your life and how you show up every day. You have no idea. You may never know what your legacy is. It's more just, I think, just how we live. Oh, and you mentioned Unmute. Some of us have been on Unmute Yourself, Your Story Matters with Anne Randolph. A new session starts tomorrow. And I've been helping her by co-hosting for a number of sessions now. They go for 4 weeks, for an hour, sometimes a bit more. And the bench that's bolted onto a cement slab won't ever fly away, hopefully. I was feeling, maybe sort of a letdown feeling recently, feeling like after I die, I'll be there in spirit. Like I totally believe that and I can see it, but I'll miss the physicalness of the completion of, you know, my death plaque on my bench and everything, having fun with the bubbles. I'm stashing bubble wands so that people have bubbles when I die, they can let the bubbles flow. Yeah, I was there this week, the other day, writing some notes in my journal and making some photos, just have a great collection of photos of my bench by the beautiful silver maple tree and all its seasons, and put a little blanket on the bench and call it my temporary home. Whenever I'm there, I just feel like I'm settling in to my little living room. Legacy, leg I see standing after I'm gone. Yeah, good one.
I break down words in unique and strange ways, but I do believe it's really poignant to say that the legacy is the leg I see standing after I'm not here. And that is what others will remember us by, not just by how we stood, but what we stood for. It's like we've all probably heard the quote, people will forget what you've said, they'll forget what you did, but they'll never forget the way that you made them feel. And so just going back to that, it's just like, I think we've been so externally oriented in terms of looking at the way that we can make a big impact and change the world, quote unquote. And then we stop seeing all of the micro worlds that we actually have with every identity that we have taken on, and then the community that got us belonging with that identity too. So I just wanted to put that forward, since legacy sometimes feels really beyond us and we won't know what it is, but that's because it's unique in the hearts of everyone that knew us.
Thank you, Laura. Stephanie.
I'm just enjoying listening. It's interesting that everybody has different perspectives that they're sharing. Rudy, I thought that you were a great speaker as well, or should I say storyteller?
Tony, you making notes? You have anything for us?
The conversation is interesting to me. Laura, your use of language is so beautiful. I love listening to you, and the way you do put words together and use words is, it's like something I've never heard before. And it's, you know, it makes me think, and I would like you to talk more so that I can learn some more from you while we're here.
Thank you.
And talking about death and all, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if I'm okay with it yet, okay with my passing. I believe that this is certainly another dimension, and that we go back to spirit and we may come back again many times to experience human form. So there's nothing really to fear. I am older than some of you guys. So I'm 73 going on 74. And I think about that every now and then, because it's, you know, you wonder about your life. Christina, you're talking about leaving a legacy. And then Lynn, I think you said, we don't really know who we've touched in our life. There will be many, many people that we really have no idea how we've impacted them. So as long as we're out interacting with people, you know, and even on this call, on virtual calls, whatever we are doing in our life, if it involves people, we have the opportunity to make a difference in their life. I have a friend that is a life coach that gets so much joy out of his coaching practice because he's impacting large companies and their employees. And I love the work that he's really doing, and the work that he's doing with me is, you know, impacts me quite greatly. So, you know, and I just have to share this. I'm very tired after the cruise. It's very draining. And even I love presenting. You know, I mentioned I have several presentations this week. For some reason, the stress of preparing, you know, you want to do a good job. You want to change people's lives. I want to change people's lives. There's a lot of stress, though, in the preparation. And I don't know if I can do this much longer if I continue to create that stress for myself. But I think cutting back is a good idea and trying to manage my schedule so there's enough self-care in there so that I can continue rather than quit. I mean, my first idea is I will just quit. I do not need to do this anymore. But Lynn knows I spent so much time, several years, you know, working on the book because I did want to reach people, and I saw that as a way, you know, obviously to impact more people without having to be present there. So I'm in this funny space today, Lynn, which was, I'm glad that you had a program. I hope to get some good sleep tonight.
Yeah.
And be refreshed so that I have the energy to go on. And Lynn knows I have a spinal issue that's causing a lot of pain. I really did not have a good day today. And my procedure is finally scheduled again for the 16th of this month. No guarantees, but I hope to be a little bit more free of the pain because it certainly impacts my energy. And, you know, I'm pushing through it. I'm going out and I'm doing things. But again, it's stress on my body.
That's
from my soul.
Yeah, I can appreciate that, you know, you have such a commitment to sharing what you have to share, which is so great. And, you know, when you're talking about maybe cutting back, it's a great thing that you're doing, and it extends beyond you so much. So I really honor your commitment to your mission and your vision for what you're able to share, Tony. And, you know, I think you can trust your intuition in how to pace yourself with that. Laura says, you may wish to look up your spinal issue and German new medicine to see what the underlying meaning is. Oh, and also Louise, hey, you can heal your life. That's another interesting one. Laura, in my message invitation to people, I was talking about our conversation this week with new terrain with perspective. And one of those things was about cremation and about leaving the body for 3 days just to make sure, like allowing the soul to leave and just to make sure that the person has departed. And I hadn't thought of that, you know, and I was talking about going to the crematorium where I've set up the trust certificate that, you know, I'd really like to go and tour where I've set this up to be done so that I can picture it ahead of time. This is a really significant commitment to make. to pay ahead for my body to be disposed of. You know, I should know more about what that process entails, because, you know, when we've gotten the ashes for different people, I always wonder, like, is this actually them? Or was it just a bunch of ashes, you know, and they just split them up and put a name on it? Like, how do you know? And what is that process? It's kind of, you know, a bit strange. But on the other hand, I never, ever since I found out about it as a child, I never wanted to be, have my body in a box rotting in the ground, like having that, you know, inch by inch, rot, rot, rot. And that just never appealed to me at all for something to look forward to. So I am still, you know, in a bit of a quandary. So anyway, Laura, do you want to talk a bit about some of that, like the 3-day thing, the 3-day rule? Interesting to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm no expert on it, but our conversation was around the fact that I've heard that the soul doesn't fully disconnect from the body for 72 hours after the death of the body. So when you had said about cremation, I said, well, it would be probably in your best interest so that you don't, who was it who said there was a near-death experience and, you know, one gentleman had woke up 3 times? Well, how long after he was declared dead that he came back into the body? It's just like, we're all here on mission to complete whatever it is that we came here to uniquely do as a individuated expression of the all that we came from. And so maybe actually it could lead into the whole maid service component, the medical assistance in dying, because I tend to believe that there is a lot going on that we're not aware of where soul ties are connected and energetic ties. And the dog barks, because it's just a sign, but I think it's really significant that this maid service is, from my perspective, creating soul ties between the administrators of the injection to remove a soul from life and then creating those karmic ties. So that's a whole side piece to what you had asked me about specifically. And I don't claim to be an expert by any means, but I do believe that energetically, there's a whole lot more to us than what we've been made aware of. And I always thought that I'd like to be cremated and then planted into, you know, the bottom of a tree and then have the tree be where I was feeding or my ashes were feeding. But now that I've been learning more about this legal fiction and the matrix that we're part of and how all of that works, I wonder if it might actually be more advantageous to have the body intact as per the embalming of the Egyptians within the pyramids, because ultimately they were aware of the spiritual and sacred aspects of death, whereas we've really been disconnected from it and made to fear it and revere it to the point of having a seeming death cult that's just, you know, fear death and fear anything that could take you there. And, you know, it's all about death in one way or another. And it's just like, what is this? Where is the life in all of this? So the whole maid service I just offer as a piece that I haven't heard anyone else speaking about, but that whole notion of being able to plan your own death ceremony and have all, you know, have your party and be able to have everybody come. And, you know, if it gets too hard and the body is ailing or failing or hurting, and it's just like, if we haven't moved the energy and motion within the physical vessel that contains our soul in order to become more whole, we're going to fragment aspects of our energy into experiences where we left a part of me. And if we don't recollect that, then we've got to, from my perspective, come back in to come back into greater wholeness. And where language is concerned, Tony, I've been on a journey in the last year, especially after having finished my book. And then it's like getting into the Justinian deception. At the end of last year, I got the drop. Justinian deception is significant. And then that led me to connect a lot of dots and take me down some rabbit holes. But I started writing the Ode to Laurelise, in fact, which is a language that I'm trying to bring forward of energy and the aura and be able to explain, though I don't have all of these answers. But what I do know is that as a community, we do. And when the sacred became secret, you know, that was the shift culturally when we stopped having access to the sacred and then it became secret. And then there was the barrier in between and you've got to, you know, pledge an oath or a vow or a contract. And I've been certified as a soul realignment practitioner since 2013, which is for accessing the Akashic records, which are the energetic database that contain all choices our soul has ever made through all time. So essentially there's like a library and you can pull your book out and it's the book of your soul. And then you can reflect back on experiences in a past life or this life where we've left pieces of our energy or created those soul ties that connect us to the one that we didn't finish business with. And I think there's a lot of unfinished business, especially the way that this whole, I call it the con video game or certificate of Vex. Identity death, AI for the one and the nine, because the vex is to cause anything, frustration, irritation, or confusion. And the courts will oftentimes use vexatious litigant as a way to remove anyone's ability to defend ourselves with a common law argument to then deem us an OPCA litigant or vexatious litigant, which just means all of the paperwork we're sending in to actually stand as a woman in my private capacity with all rights reserved outside of the public sphere is ultimately going to take away their power, which is frustrating and irritating indeed. So it's vexatious. And then if we don't know how to contend the application of such a label, status, personage, title, then ultimately there's a conversion that takes place. And it's the conversion threat that's ultimately making us believe ourselves to be other than what we actually are, which is the danger of identities generally. But I went down a whole bunch of different rabbit holes. And I know that I oftentimes kind of talk at a high level and that it's kind of needing to come down and ground too. And I also know that I don't have all the answers, but I do know that I feel like this is important information to bring forward for us to be able to say, okay, what does this mean to and for us? How does it sit and fit? And then what am I going to do with it is always the piece that actually takes it from the head into the heart where we can start actually using it. So there's my offer.
It's always refreshing to hear new words and symbols expressed.
I just looked at the time.
You've got to go.
Well, I must, but it has been an absolute delight being with all of you. And I thank each of you for sharing your stories and allowing me to share my perspectives and story as well. Thank you, Lynn, for the invitation. This is wonderful. I'm glad you did it.
Thank you so much, Laura. We'll talk soon.
Beautiful. Thanks so much, guys. Ciao for now.
Well, what a place to leave us. My goodness. Any thoughts from anyone?
It's just wonderful that we can sit here and listen and take in what others are thinking, what their beliefs are in this moment or have been forever. And, you know, just the little lights that are going on for me is the similarity is, okay, yes, I hear you. All right, that's another explanation. And it's, you know, just even with Laura that just left is around, as my faith is Baha'i, we are to be buried within 1 hour's distance of where we died. And I haven't delved into why is that, you know? And so the connection of our spirit, our soul to our body, it's an interesting question. We will find all the answer, I guess, in the next stage, right? In the next world. But it's fascinating, the connections and how what you've shared, I'm just really resonating with a lot of it. So thank you.
So, Suze, you said that according to the Baha'i belief that you're to be, I never heard this before, that you're to be buried within an hour's like drive from where you die?
Drive, it could be a plane, it could be helicopter, whatever vehicle it is, but there is some significance. And I've just always felt that made sense to me. I don't know why it always did, so I haven't delved into it. And the other thing, we're never alone. You know, we are continually guided. We think we're this individual, But it's like Rudy with his dad speaking to him right away when he left his mortal frame. It was like he was just right there and he knew what he needed to say to this son of his to kind of wake him up.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, and here's Bobby. Hello, Bobby. So for those of you who have not been here before, which is Suze and Stephanie, this is Bobby Rowntree coming in live.
Bursting in live. I can't see anybody else but you.
Right. Yes. Well, we can see you. Oh, we've just been having the most amazing time. Laura just left. And, oh, yes, your dog.
Griffin's here too. Yeah.
So, Bobby, would you like to take a few minutes to introduce yourself?
I am Bobby. I just came from my stepson's football game, so I can't feel my fingers. And it went much longer than they did. They were victorious. I felt very bad for the other team. I am a medium. I live on Vancouver Island currently. I'm sure everyone knows what a medium is. I was born this way. If you don't know what a medium is, I actually am able to communicate with people who have crossed over. And all the other things out there too, but mainly people who've crossed over. That's my thing. I'm all about it. Not sure even what else to say about myself. I'm a little, I just came and ran down here and got on the computer, so I didn't want to miss any more of what was going on, because I love these arts of departure, the art of departure, arts of departure. I think that this is a topic that people should be talking about more, that it should be more openly spoken of. Yes, Lynn's approach to death and dying and passing, I think, is healthy as heck. Yes. My favorite quote I tell when someone said to you, "Are you dying?" You said, "Aren't you?" My favorite Lynn quote. So, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure what else to say about myself. I'm a mother of three. I just wrote a book. Thank you, Lynn. And that's about it. I talk to the dead for a living. That's, yeah.
The dead for a living. Yeah.
I do. That's what I do. Yeah.
Yeah, very good. In 2 weeks, right now, we're going to have a couple hours of November readings, short readings with Bobby for whoever shows up. Yes.
Hopefully, we'll be able to say whoever shows up. It'd be just me and you. Well, and your sister, your mother, your father. There's that too.
Yes. Yes. It's a busy time because?
Because the veil is thin.
Ah.
Because the veil is so very, very thin. It's a little bit better now. We're going into November 5th. So everybody's going back into their prospective closets. But the month of October is a very active month when it comes to people on the other side. Because that's what Halloween is, really. Samhain. It is the honoring of the dead and those who have gone before us. It's the end of the year. And then the beginning of the new year coming towards solstice. So that's, yeah.
So November 1st is like a new year. That's always felt like that to me. Is that so?
Yeah. Yeah. All Saints Day is what the Catholics call it. But yeah, it's like the new year. It's the end of the harvest. But depending on where your belief system lies, a lot of people will see April 1st as the new year because it comes in with Beltane and the new year. That's why April Fool's Day exists, because pagans would think that was the new year. And then they would call them fools, April Fools. Because the new year was back in January, 4 months before. So, yeah. Because it's never made sense that January is the new year. It's not the difference of a season. It's actually right in the middle. But it's good to have that party there so people feel a little bit better about how cold it is outside, in my opinion. So, yeah.
Bobby, I've got a question for you. Laura, who just left just before you arrived, she was talking about the maid service, you know, medical assistance in dying. You know, we didn't get to the point of mentioning that in Canada, they're extending it to anybody who just doesn't feel like living, which is really scary. Well, one of the things that she mentioned, if I got this right, and anyone can confirm or add to this, but my impression from what she said was that there might be something that's sort of splintered, that's not like the person's soul may not be intact through that procedure, that there might be something incomplete is the way I took it. And also that there may be sort of a karmic contract between the person administering the injection with the person who is selected to arrange a time to die. Thoughts?
Yeah, that's an excellent ethical question, really. And okay, so the soul intact thing, is she, do I understand it that the question is whether or not the soul that crosses over is completely intact as it would be if she, the person crossed over in a natural state.
That's right.
Yeah, I've never really seen people who do MAID as going to the suicide realm, but you go to the suicide realm if your actions lead to your passing, and that passing be an untimely one. But if you have mental health reasons or actual justifiable reasons to want to go to the other side, you kind of get a come in and go out pass. So I've never seen someone who has done MAID in the suicide realm. It actually goes progresses in through their natural passing. Because, yeah, because our idea of death and their idea of death, it's like our idea of marriage and their idea of marriage. It's merely a suggestion to them. It's merely like you have MAID this choice and therefore this is real. So they're showing the same thing with the death. That it's not bad. It's not, it has to be ceremony or anything like that. There's something like that that I'm hearing. But also actually, I would say that the karmic part with the person who's letting the person go over, they're doing a merciful act. It's not a bad act. This idea that death is bad is an idea that we have, rather than what they have. They see it as, oh yeah, come on home. So if you're suffering and you decide to go home, then yeah, it does not splinter the soul. Not one single bit. That's a big thing I gotta say. It does not splinter the soul. Not a bad idea, not a bad thing. But yeah, the karmic thing, that's a very, very interesting idea to me, because logically you would think so. But in my head, the people who are talking to me are, no, you're actually, it's an honor.
Wow. Well, it's very interesting. Yeah, I sort of see MAID sort of, well, it's sort of different, but the other end of it being a C-section, like where, you know, you schedule the time to come in, mm-hmm. you schedule the time to go out.
We're having so many C-sections now, I could completely see people starting to choose their expiry date. That's what I call it, your expiry date.
Yes.
Because it's not, death is an ending to something. It's just a transition from one form to another.
Well, yeah, and Laura was, I think it was Laura, was saying how there's such a thing around death being, you know, like this, the last thing you want to do is die. And
yes,
yet it's
at least also, they lived.
What's that?
At least they lived. People say that all the time. Well, at least they lived. No, but now they have to go see a psychiatrist every day of their life because their brains can't deal with what happened to them. Things like that. Yeah, sometimes it's better to die. Sometimes it's better to reset.
Sorry, they have to go and see somebody. Why?
Oh, because sometimes when people go through a tragedy or a horrific thing, the big thing people will say, well, at least they lived through it or they got through it. Like that is the end all be all of our goals, is to keep living. And it is for people. People are terrified of death. They won't even let themselves wrinkle. That's why I think people don't wrinkle, because they're scared. If they get old and they're going to get obsolete, and if they get obsolete, then they're slowly going to become dust and they're going to die. And yeah, I don't think that way. All the dead people I know were very lively, so active. That's probably a much better word, active. Yes.
So you're at ease with your wrinkles.
I am completely at ease with my wrinkles because they're very hard to see. Because I'm only 52, so I might not be as at ease with them when I'm 72. But yeah, but I'm looking down the barrel now. We all are. Once you get over 50, you're like, well, there's less time than before. That's just the way it is. And if there's more time than before, ugh, how's that going to be? So, yeah, that's, I'm cavalier about death. Very, very cavalier about death. And I know I can be offensive sometimes, and I hope I haven't offended anyone. I can't see anyone, so I don't know if I'm offending anyone. So I apologize if I'm too cavalier and offended someone.
Is there anyone who Bobby can't see who would like to say something to Bobby and so can see you?
Your dad still start talking.
Well, I could only be offended if I had something to defend.
Ah, and that's
if
good.
There's anything I'm learning, I'm being reminded of again. I'm not, I know it well, but I'm reminded again and again of how little I know. And
isn't that funny?
The older I get, the less I know, and the less I'm sure of, and the more I understand. I think it was Laura who said earlier that she's trying to become increasingly aware of her BS, her belief system. You know, I have my belief system around death, and it doesn't jive with someone else's, perhaps. There's so much I don't understand about the whole process. But what I know at this point in my life is I'm open to the mystery, and I'm willing to plead ignorance and just say, that's interesting what you have to say, without needing to agree with it or disagree with it, and just say, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a perspective.
Thanks, Rudy, for that. It's relaxing and enervating and calming to just be able to get together like this and share different perspectives and insights without having to agree or understand even, you know, just listen, take it in. Just two little insights I wanted to share from either end of this mystery. The only person I ever saw born was my niece, my sister's daughter. And I remember at the time, my sister was, you know, I mean, pretty anxious. I've never given birth, but it looks like a pretty intense process. And the nurses that were there were, you know, they were talking about whatever. And she was really annoyed, like, hey, I'm having a baby here. I know you've delivered like 100 of them or whatever, but this is the one I'm delivering. Pay attention now. So I remember that. And then on the other end of it, this friend, Paul, keeps coming back. He lived into his 90s, and he and his wife, Joy, they'd been married for like 73 years. And they lived in two different parts of the house towards the end. And he was down in the basement where the wood stove was, and he had his own space down there. And she had her little delicate, more tea time spot upstairs. They had a granddaughter, or great-granddaughter, helping for a while. Anyway, I was so blessed to hear the story of his death from his grandson. And what had happened was that a number of the family were there, like he had summoned them because he knew his time was coming. And I think they set him up with a baby monitor so that he could call out and let them know to come down to his space during the night. And so there was a couple of false alarms, and then it was time. And so they were down, and they were talking about something else. And he said, hello, hello, I'm dying here. You know, pay attention. This is what's happening. And I put those two stories together, you know, and I just love that. And I thought, you know, we can take command of how we leave. I really do believe that. There was this other friend, Beatrice, who I've mentioned, who told me shortly before she died that she was really afraid of dying by choking, you know, of being in stress. And I said, you know, I don't know much about it, but I feel like you can choose to go calmly. And she did, I found out later. And so I felt really good about that because I didn't know much. I mean, this was 1996. I knew very little. But I remember meeting this guy who was a reader, a channeler. And I remember just feeling so grateful to realize that I was not alone and that I was constantly being witnessed. And so if I was having what I thought was just a meaningful private interaction with someone who I felt like it was a positive benefit in our interaction, that was not unseen. That was being witnessed. And I remember that so clearly in the late 90s, just really being comforted by that and emboldened, empowered to know that I was always being supported and seen. That made a really big difference in my development, in forming my legacy of connection and connectivity. Yes. Yes, Stephanie, please speak.
For Tony, with quantum reality, the long story short is that when you look at the smallest measurement of everything you see, everything is energy vibrating at different frequencies. So a physical manifestation, a physical ailment, is congested energy. So emotions that we're holding in that has nowhere else to go. So it manifests physically. So if you look, the first place I always go to with all of my clients when it comes to physical manifestations is the Louise Hay list of ailments. You can Google it yourself. And for back issues, which is a ton of people because of the reasons why. So for back issues, it represents the support of life. Back problems. So rounded shoulders is carrying all the burdens of life, helpless and hopeless. I found this interesting just based on your work and what you're doing. Lower back pain is fear of money or lack of financial support. Mid back pain is guilt. stuck in all that stuff back there. Get off my back. Upper back pain is lack of emotional support, feeling unloved, holding back love, back curvature, the inability to flow with the support of life, fear and trying to hold on to old ideas, not trusting life, lack of integrity, no courage of convictions. So again, if you want to find that to read it more, you just Google Louise Hay list of ailments. Energy medicine is everything's energy. So if you want something to change, you have to change the energy.
Well, there's a lot of good affirmations to go with each of those as well. Go ahead, Bobby. Thank you, Stephanie.
Just further to what Stephanie said. Hello, Stephanie. I don't think I've met you before. That's cool. I'm a fan of Louise Hay as well. Would you agree possibly that a correlation between the chakra in that spot is part of what Louise Hay is talking about? Like pain here has to do with not feeling loved because this is your heart chakra. And pain here, guilt, because now you don't have power. And that's why you're feeling pain here, lower back, close to the root chakra, which is our money chakra. I was just curious because that's what I saw. Because I'm a chakra. I like my chakras, obviously. I'm big on the chakra. Yeah.
So when it comes to like for chakras, I would definitely agree with that 100%. When it comes to the chakras, though, I practice scanning the biofield with a tuning fork. So where you hear, right, so you're scanning every single chakra, wherever you hear dissonance in the field, that would be the energy that left that chakra during trauma or challenging times. So what you can do with the tuning fork is move, and you can literally hear it. So you can move that energy that's stuck in the field, and you can drop it back into the chakra. So it doesn't mean that the trauma never happened. It just lessens the emotional instability because of the trauma. But definitely, I would absolutely say the same thing. Yeah. It's all an entire system, right? And it's all it's all energy.
The voices in my head were saying, it's like, go with the flow. Because I wasn't sure if placing G or actually just moving it out and creating more of a flow of the energy that's already there.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's like that row, row, row your boat gently down the stream, right? Surrender, right? Yeah. I also like to, I call it decoding your reality too, right? Because we're manifesting everything. So everything is there for a reason, trying to tell us something. It's just quieting the subconscious programmed mind so that you can hear what it is that you need to hear in order to move forward. Yeah, connecting back into like the motherboard of the game, connecting back, like plugging yourself back into consciousness so that you can, it's like your cheat code for this video game. You can hear, you know, okay, this is where I need to go. This is, and also you can feel it.
Oh, agreed. Absolutely agreed. Yeah. Our body tells us what our mind is missing because our mind is ever so stupid. So yeah, I've seen this, so that is true. Rather than,
it's the subconscious programmed mind, right? It can't think new thoughts. And statistically speaking, 90% of the population lives from their subconscious programmed mind 95 to 99% of the time. So they're just on repeat creating the same thing, thinking the same thoughts, feeling the same emotions, creating the same reality. So until you start to reprogram that mind and think from your conscious mind, right? So Lynn, when you asked me if I had any thoughts, for me, my daily thing is living in the present moment, you know, aware of my surroundings. So you sort of caught me off guard, but at the same time, I don't think about death a whole lot. I'm like consciously in the moment playing my video game, being mindfully aware of what I'm creating next. So, but it's also my first time here. I'm not too sure how this also goes down.
I think about death constantly.
Think about death constantly?
Because I believe that when I die, I'm going to find out why I'm able to do what I do. And I'm going to find out whether or not I was successful or if I did it right for them. Because I believe I work for people up there. That's what I believe.
Tony, did you have any response to this back counsel business through Louise Hay? Did you have any thoughts on that?
I'll check into it. It sounds interesting. I've been aware of Louise Hay and haven't done any reading with her for several decades. Oh. So she's fallen by the wayside. I mean, it looks like an old book I probably have in my library.
Yeah, my cousin gave me this in 1990.
Okay, yeah. That's about right for me. I'll look into that. I'm very curious about illnesses and why they manifest. And especially, I also have a rare disease that I was diagnosed with. And I was just at a health fair that was with other patients, other people, and it's myasthenia gravis. And it was very interesting. And one of the doctors in the area was there as well, who I had been on Zoom with. So it was an in-person health fair event. So yeah, sharing treatment plans, and you know, we're all like, how did we get this rare disease? I mean, it just hits you out of nowhere. All of a sudden you're sick and you've got this diagnosis that you're dealing with. So that's something else that I'm extremely curious about.
I see Stephanie's and Rudy wants to say something too. Go ahead, Stephanie.
I'd highly suggest looking into Bruce Lipton. If you haven't heard of him yet, definitely, definitely epigenetics and Bruce Lipton. It's well worth the time, definitely. Like, he's a game changer for sure.
Thank you, Stephanie and Tony and Rudy. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say goodbye. It's time for me to sign off.
Yes, it is.
In conversation and for stretching my mind. That's what more could you ask of a Sunday night?
That's right.
Those of you who are on mute, I'll see you tomorrow. And
night, Rudy. See you tomorrow. You. Thank you for all your input. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Pleasure. Goodbye. Thank you.
Christina.
Yeah, I just want to say something about I followed Lipton, I guess, since The Secret, since the movie was put out years ago, Bruce Lipton. And those dudes, epigenetics, I heard a good one the other day, you know, how much our trauma could be ancestral and in the subconscious. And they did a study in epigenetics where, so a rat is, they have like cherry pie or something, a smell, just an example. So this, so the rat smells this cherry pie and then they hit them with a shock treatment, like a shock. So their body, you know, goes into shock. And after a while, the rat will smell it and the body will contract automatically before they get the shock, just automatic. But the study goes that six generations of rats, the sixth generation, not three, but six generations, the rat will have the exact same reaction as six generations prior. Isn't that crazy, right? So that's like, that's epigenetics. And so we don't know, of course, what's in our, there's enough in this body in this lifetime, but you know, the stories of someone being afraid of drowning or strangling or whatever, those stories usually come from some past life. And there was a guy that did a lot of past life regressions. And
you're thinking, you know, of Edgar Casey?
Yeah, Edgar Casey's one. There was another, he became really well known for taking people back. And so if you'd have this fear of drowning, you might discover through past life regression that the mother tried to abort them in a bathtub. Or it could go back three generations. So that someone will say, oh my God, your grandfather, your great grandfather. So that's why the importance of stories going on generation to generation. It's like we can never lose that ability of storytelling, because a lot of clues will be found in the family system of something that's occurring now where we can't explain it, including disease. It's not that it's genetic necessarily. It's at the source of the problem. Like Louise Hay was able to cure her own cancer, which is why she became so well known for her work in that. And each body part connects to something, like the lower back pain is lack of support, heart, like, so all these things. Yes, there's the external world, but there's this internal. And so I think we're all our own healers, and we all have the ability when we can go to the metaphysical of a disease or a trauma rather than what's going on outside of us. But the epigenetics was fascinating, to six generations of a memory.
Yeah, indeed. That's very fascinating, Christina. Bobby, you have raised your hand.
Anywho, okie dokie, I'll just talk then. I am an actual example of when energy gets trapped in a human body. I have actual lumps, balls in my body that travel up and down my spine. I have one that is at the base of my skull that has grown and grown and grown that I can feel pulsate when there are metaphysical things around, when there are things I need to look at around. Because at the base of your skull, in the Kundalini energy map, let's say, it's where our third eye and crown chakra meet. It's the two snakes. The snakes that you see that are Kundalini energy, that is the medical system. They have actually taken that symbol that is Kundalini energy. Every time those snakes cross, they cross over an energy spot within you. I agree with Christine in this idea that, as I believe, it's not ancestral energy that I'm carrying. I believe that ancestral energy is a different sort of thing that does more with my mind and psyche than it does with my human body. I believe that that energy within my human body is trapped because of what I do and what I'm able to do and how I move energy up and down my spine all the time. And that's because I believe that the spine is the superhighway to our metaphysical or spiritual or psychic selves. So I think that when you have owies in between there, it's telling you more about the work you need to do and what you might want to look at with yourself, having to do with your chakras and things like that. So that is what I wanted to say.
And I'm really glad you were able to join us for some of it, Bobby. Thank you so much. And Stephanie, for the first time, inaugural. Yeah. Awesome. I love that my question caught you off guard. Do you have any thoughts? I mean, I wouldn't normally say that, I guess. But maybe you drew me to you to ask you that.
Tony, are you there? Yeah. Could I ask you what part of the body or body parts that you're, is it blood or is it bones or is it the rare disease?
The myasthenia gravis affects vision, the eyes, usually double vision, which I still have. It's not under control. When it progresses, it affects the muscles, usually in the upper body only. It's a neuromuscular autoimmune disease. So the immune system is affected as well.
Okay. Well, we're sending you some healing love and vibes and I'll do a little
thank you.
Stephanie?
I just think everything's energy, right? So in my head, I'm like, geez, I got a Tesla machine. I got my Rife machine. I got my Sonopie. So yeah. But
what's a Tesla machine?
It's from the early 1900s.
Wow. I know the Rife machine. Oh, wow.
It uses the violet ray technology. These are glass blown, so it's shaped for different parts of the body.
Wow.
And this is the vacuum. So basically what this does, you hold on to it and it pumps oxygen through your body. The first time I tried it, I used this. So I was doing yoga, but there was one ankle that I couldn't stand on for very long. It just had this pain. So I did this for literally 5 minutes and I haven't felt it since. And that was a few years ago. They all attach into this and wow. You can literally see like the violet ray come through this and you can cool. do specific body parts.
That's wow. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty cool. I love it. My magic find. My Rife machine is like, I did my massive due diligence before I purchased that one, and it's pretty spectacular. It's like the most powerful thing that you can purchase.
My friend used it for lymphatic cancer. I mean, it helped with the pain, but it didn't save his life, but it did help with.
Yeah. And that's the thing too. There's so many devices that claim to be like Rife machines and they can't possibly be like, they've got these stupid wands and there's no way to get to the frequency required to match the Rife frequencies. And there's like, I've got a book full of all the different ailments and all the different frequencies that you tune in to do. There's so many garbage devices out there that it's not doing what you think, like what you paid for it to do or what you thought it was going to do. Like my Rife machine takes 2 plugs.
I'm curious about the Tesla.
Just to think like it, these were in people's homes. Like this is before the last reset, right? Before 1918, when we used to know that this is who we are and how we function. You know, there was bells everywhere. The churches rang out like healing frequencies to the people around. You know, we knew that everything was energy vibrating at different frequencies, and that's how we functioned. And then, of course, the narcissistic psychopath stepped in, did their last reset, and
somebody said the other day that they weren't allowed to use a megaphone. And I said, then why don't you use a xylophone? Because that would be frequencies, right?
Yeah. Well, and then, and that's the other thing too, right? Then they manipulate frequencies. That's the flip side. However, there is nothing more powerful than like a conscious human who knows who they are, you know, and is deliberately, intentionally using their thoughts and emotions and tuning into higher states of consciousness. And that not only changes the individual's life, but that changes the entire quantum field and every single human in it. Now, according to the Lebanon Peace Project, we already have enough people right now to do this, to change the entire quantum field and turn war off like a light switch.
I was just reading about HAARP and the frequencies that they put out, that they can change the mood. They can change a mood of a city with a certain frequency. And we don't hear the frequency because it's usually beyond the human capacity to hear, like the dogs that I'm hearing in the next room.
We are way more powerful than whatever they do.
So we have to raise our frequency, because as Tesla, the real Tesla, said, everything in the universe is energy, frequency, and vibration.
We're living in a, like I say, a video game reality. You know, we're creating it all.
The whole Tesla car has to, so that we think that's Tesla and we forget. Wait a minute.
I taught psychology at a local college and I asked the kids if they knew about Tesla, and they were like, the car guy? Like, they had no idea. But no matter what they do, there's nothing that they can do, you know? It's game over for the Matrix.
It's totally game over.
Thoughts?
I just appreciate everybody being here. Thank you, Lynn, for putting this together.
Glad you're able to join us, Tony.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you so much. Good night. All blessings.